A shadow of irritation at importunate youth passed behind the king's eyes. Then he sighed. "Who knows?" he agreed. "Who knows where the enemy lies?" "The enemy lies before you, great king. He has crossed the Shashi River, and he has come to take your land from you," Somabula told him. And then Gundang stood again. "Let the spears go, Lobengula, son of Mzilikatsi. Let your young men run. Or as the sun will rise tomorrow, that surely will be something you will live to regret."
"That I cannot do," Lobengula said softly. "Not yet. I cannot use the assegai when words may still suffice." He roused himself, and his voice firmed. "Go, Gundang, my brother. Take your hot-hearted son with you. Go to the leader of these soldiers and ask him why he comes into my lands in battle array, and bring his answer to me here."
Frederick Saluz rode ahead, a trooper with an axe following him, and he pointed out the trees to be cut. The trooper blazed them with a slash of the axe and followed Saluz on. The axemen came up behind them, 50 of them, riding in pairs. One man dismounted, handed his reins to his partner, spat on his already calloused hands, and hefting the axe, addressed himself to the trunk of the doomed tree. While his axe thudded and the wood chips flew, white as bone in the sunlight, the second man sat in the saddle, his rifle in his hands, and he watched the forest around him for the first plumed head and long tasseled shield to appear. When the tree crackled and toppled, the axeman mounted, and they rode on to the next, where he took his turn on guard while his mate swung the axe. Behind them, the bullock spans came plodding to chain the fallen trunks and drag them out of the road, and then the whole ponderous caravan rumbled forward. It was slow work, and on the third day Ralph rode to the head of the column to discuss with Saluz the possibility of using the steam engine to haul the smaller trees, roots and all, from the sandy earth. They had left their horses with a trooper and walked forward for a better view of the way ahead when Ralph said quietly, "Stand your ground, Mr. Saluz. Do not draw your pistol, and in God's name do not show any agitation." There were dark and moving shadows in the forest all around them, and then suddenly the dreaded long shields were there, forming a wall across their front.
"Has the king killed any white men?" a deep voice challenged. "If he has not, then why has this impi of warriors crossed his border?"
"Lobengula has killed nobody," Ralph called back.
"Then have the white men mislaid something of value, that they come to seek it here?" Ralph said quietly to Saluz.
"I know this man. He's one of the king's senior indunas. The one with the red shield behind him is his son. Between them they disposed of 8,000 men. It would be as well to tread warily, Mr. Saluz. We are surrounded by an army." Then he addressed himself to the watching and waiting warriors.
"The king has given us the road."
"The king denies that he called an army to enter his domain."
"We are not an army," Ralph denied, and Gundang threw back his head and laughed briefly and bitterly. Then he spoke again.
"Hear me, Henshaw. No white man steps beyond this place without the word of Lobengula. Tell that to your masters."
Ralph whispered briefly with Saluz, and then faced Gundang again.
"We'll wait," he agreed, "for the king's word." "And we will watch while you wait," Gundang promised ominously. And at a gesture, the warriors melted away into the forest again, and it seemed they had never been.
"Pull in the pickets," Colonel Pennyfather ordered. "Put the wagons into laager. Ballantyne, can you get a message back to Thule on the heliograph, and have someone post up to Gubulawayo to find out what are Lobengula's real intentions?" And as Ralph turned to hurry away, "Oh, one other thing, Ballantyne. Can you start the generator and have the searchlight ready to sweep the area around the camp tonight? We don't want those fellows creeping up on us in the dark." Gundang and his son stood together on the crest of one of the little rocky koppies that dotted the wide, hot plain between the rivers. They were alone, although when Butso turned his head and looked down the steep back slope of the hill, he could see the bivouac of their combined impis. There were no cooking fires to disclose their presence to the white men. They would eat cold rations and sleep in darkness this night. The long black ranks squatted with enforced patience, dense as hiving bees beneath the shading branches of the Mupani. Butso knew that he had only to lift his right arm above his shield to bring them to their feet and send them racing away, silent and ferocious as hunting leopards, and the thought gave him a savage joy. Reluctantly he turned back and stood quietly with his shield not quite touching his father's. The little afternoon breeze coming up from the river stirred their war plumes, and they gazed down upon the lager of the white men. The bullocks had been penned within the circle of the wagons, and they could see the field guns and the Maxim machine guns posted at the points of the barricade, their positions fortified with biscuit boxes and ammunition cases from the wagon loads. The gun crews lounged near their wagons, yet somehow the whole scene appeared tranquil and unwarlike.
"In the dark hour before the dawn, we could take them before they could stand to their guns," murmured Butso. "It would be so quick, so easy."
"We will wait on the king's word," his father replied, and then started and exclaimed,
"What is it, my father?"
Gundang lifted his assegai and pointed with it southwards to the pale blue horizon far beyond the Shashi River, to the faint line of hills shaped as fantastically as the turreted towers of a fairy castle. On those far pale hills something flickered and sparkled, a tiny speck of brightest white light, like a firefly in flight, or like the twinkle of the morning star.
"The stars," Gundang whispered with superstitious awe, "the stars are shining on the hills."
The little group of officers stood behind the tripod of the instrument and focused their telescopes on the distant twinkle of light. The heliograph operator called the message aloud, at the same time scribbling it on his signal pad. "Jove advises hold your position pending clarification Lobengula's intention." Jove was the code name for Rhodes. "Very well." Pennyfather closed his telescope with a snap. "Acknowledge message received and understood." The operator bent to the prism of the instrument and made a minute adjustment in its focus, turning one mirror to catch the sunlight and the second to reflect it directly towards the line of distant hills. Then he seized the handle and the shutter clattered as it blinked the beam of sunlight, speeding the dots and dashes of the Morse code instantaneously across 50 miles of wilderness. Pennyfather turned away and crossed briskly to the massive steam engine on its tall steel wheels. He looked up at Ralph on the footplate. "Are you ready to light up, Ballantyne?" Ralph removed the long black cheroot from between his teeth and gave a parody of a military salute. "We got 60 pounds of pressure on the boiler. Another half an hour and she'll be whistling out of the valve." "Very well," Pennyfather hid his mystification. He neither understood nor admired these demoniacal contraptions. "Just as long as we have light by nightfall." Gundang sat on his shield with his fur kaross of monkey skins over his shoulders. The winter evenings were cold, even here in the lowlands. There were no fires in the bivouac, and he could barely make out the faces of his junior commanders who sat opposite him, for the last flush of the sunset was fading from the western sky.
"It was something that all of us saw, and something that we have never seen before." They murmured agreement. "It was a star fallen from the heavens, and it lay upon the hills. We all saw it. In the morning I will send 2 of our swiftest runners to the king. He must know of this terrible witchcraft."
He stood up and let his kaross fall.
"Now I am go—"
He did not finish the sentence. Instead he dropped into a defensive crouch and flung up his shield to cover his head, and around him his warriors wailed like frightened children, their eyes wide and white, glinting in the flood of light that burst down upon them from the sky. The evening stars were washed out by the brilliance of the great white beam that reached from earth to heaven, and threw the hills into crisp black silhouette.
"The sun has returned," Gundang croaked in religious terror. "It is the prophecy, the whole prophecy. The stone falcons have flown, the stars shine on the hills, and now the sun burns at midnight.
Fort Salisbury, 20th September, 1890. My darling Kate, over 2 months since last I kissed you, and I am missing your cooking, amongst other things. You will see by the address that we have reached our destination, although we lost a man drowned, another to drink, a third bitten by a mamba, and a fourth eaten by a lion. The Matabele touched not one of us. So Lobengula kept his word, to the surprise of all, and the disappointment of not a few. After one exchange of insults with old Gundung at the head of 8,000 of his bully boys, they let us pass, and the rest of it was rather tedious, just sweat and blisters. The great Salus almost lost us once, but then I showed him the pass through the hills which Izazi and I found when we made our little foray to Great Zimbabwe. Salus called it Providential Pass, providential that I was with him, I'd say, and he took the kudos, to which he's welcome. He'll probably write another book about his feat. We reached Mount Hamden on the 6th inst, and it gave me a turn to think that Papa had been the first man here all those years ago. However, Pennyfather, in his great wisdom, decided there was insufficient water here and moved us all 12 miles across. Of course, the man is a new chum, fresh out from home, so how is he to know that this place will turn into a swamp when the first rains come? I intend to be well away by then. I have visited some godforsaken places on my travels, but this one gets the coconut. It's infested with lions, and I've lost 15 oxen to them already. The grazing is sour felt. The remaining beasts are losing condition. Oh, how I long for the sweet felt of Matabele land. Trust the Matabele to pick the best stock country. So I'll not be too surprised when others start thinking about Lobengula's herds and pastures. If only the cunning old blighter had thrown his war spear and given us the excuse, we might be hoisting the flag over Gubulawaya now, rather than over this dreary spot. Oh well, at least I'm the only one here with whiskey. 2 wagon loads of it, and doing a roaring trade at £10 the bottle. You shall have the prettiest bonnet in Kimberley when I return, Katie, my heart. The day Pennyfather hoisted the flag, the boys were free to go their own way. And what a stampede there was! Everyone intent to be the first to peg the gold reef we've heard so much about. Some of them are crawling back already, tail between their legs. This is no El Dorado. If there is gold, they'll have to work for it. And then, of course, Mr. Rhodes and his British South Africa company will take half of it. Of course, they all were happy enough about the company's cut when they signed on. But they're starting to bellyache about it now, I can tell you. We had a message on the Helio this morning that the British South Africa Company shares are selling for £3.15 each in London, and 5,000 new shareholders on the books in the first week. Well, all I can say is that whoever is paying that price has never seen Fort Salisbury. "Young Ballantyne," says Leander Starr Jamieson to me, "you were damnably lucky to take half your fees payable in BSA shares valued at £1 each." "Jamieson," says I, "it's strange how the harder I work and the harder I think, the luckier I get." So I have 40,000 BSA shares, Katie, my love, and you will find here attached a letter addressed to Aaron Fagan, my solicitor in Kimberley, instructing him to sell every last one of them. Take it around to him post-haste, that's a good girl. We'll be well rid of them at a profit of £2.15 each, and that's God's truth. Perhaps I'll buy you 2 bonnets when I come back. Oh, if only we had Matabele land. No wonder Lobengula left Mashona land to the Mashonas, though they don't call it that any more. The new name that's all the rage is Rhodesia, no less. What an ungainly name it is, but no doubt Mr. Rhodes will be flattered, and my brother Jordan will be delighted. They are welcome to my share of Rhodesia. Don't forget to take the letter to Fagan, mind. Nonetheless, there is still a penny to be made here. I've taken a partner, and we are building a general store and barroom. He will run both businesses as well as the Salisbury depot for my wagons. He seems an honest lad, our Tom Meikle, and hard working, so I've given him a wage of £5 a month and 10% of the profits. No point in spoiling him. Just as soon as we get the building up and the stocks on the shelves, I will leave him to it and be on my way back to you. Mr. Rhodes wants me to contract to erect the telegraph line from Kimberley to Fort Salisbury for him at a price of £25,000. I reckon there'll be £10,000 profit in it. You shall have 3 bonnets, Katie. I swear it to you. I must leave here by the 10th of next month if I am to beat the rains. Once they start, the mosquitoes are going to take over Fort Salisbury, and every river between here and the Shashi will be a flood that would break even Noah's heart. Thus, I expect to reach Kimberley by the end of October. So take a good look at the floor, Katie, my sweet, for when I get there, you'll be looking at naught but the ceiling for a week, and my word on it. Your loving husband, Ralph Ballantyne, ex-Major BSA, police retired. We must have Matabeleland. It's as simple as that, said Zuga Ballantyne, and Jordan looked up sharply from his pad of Pitman's shorthand. His father sat in one of the deep-buttoned leather chairs facing Mr. Rhodes's desk. Beyond him the green velvet curtains were open and held with yellow-tasseled ropes of silk. The view from this top floor of the De Beers Company buildings took in a wide sweep of the dry Griqualand plain, dotted with camel-thorn trees, and closer to hand the stacking ground where the blue earth from the Kimberley mine was left to deteriorate in the brilliant sunshine before being made to yield up its precious diamonds. Jordan had no eyes for the view now. His father's words had shocked him. But Mr. Rhodes merely hooded his eyes and slumped massively at his desk, gesturing for Zuga to continue. The company shares are 6 shillings in London, against £3.15 on the day we raised the flag at Fort Salisbury 3 years ago. I know, Rhodes nodded. I have spoken with the men that remain. I have spent the last 3 months travelling from Fort Victoria to Salisbury, as you bid me. They won't stay, Mr. Rhodes. They won't stay unless you let them go in and finish it.
Matabeleland,
Rhodes lifted his great shaggy head. And Jordan thought how terribly he had aged in these last 3 years.
Matabeleland, he repeated softly.
They are sick of the constant menace of Lobengula's hordes upon their borders. They have convinced themselves that the gold they did not find in Mashonaland lies under Lobengula's earth. They have seen Lobengula's fat herds of choice cattle and compared them to their own lean beasts that starve on the thin sour felt to which they are restricted.
Go on.
Rhodes nodded. They know that to reach them, the telegraph and the railroad must come through Matabeleland. They are sick to the guts with malaria and the constant fear of the Matabele. If you want to keep Rhodesia, you must give them Matabeleland.
I have known this all along. I think we all have. Yet we must move carefully. We must be careful of the imperial factor, of Gladstone and of Whitehall.
Rhodes stood up and began to pace back and forth before the shelves laden with leather-bound books titled in gold leaf.
We need to prepare ourselves. You must remember, Ballantyne, that we are technically only the right to dig for gold there. As long as Lobengula does not molest us, we cannot declare war upon him.
But if Lobengula were to interfere in any way with our people and their rights?
Well, that would be another matter.
Rhodes stopped in front of Zuga's chair.
Then I should certainly end his game for him.
In the meantime, the company's shares are 6 shillings each, Zuga reminded him.
We need an incident, said Rhodes. But in the meantime, we have to prepare, and I dare not put it on the wires. I want you to leave immediately for Fort Victoria to speak to Jamieson.
Rhodes swung his big head towards Jordan.
Do not make notes of this, Jordan, he ordered.
And Jordan dutifully lifted his pencil from the pad.
Instruct Jamieson to send me a series of telegrams on the new wires. Telegrams advising against war, that we can show the British government and people when it is all over. But in the meantime, tell him to prepare for war.
Rhodes turned back to Jordan.
Take an instruction, Jordan. Sell 50,000 BSA company shares for what they'll fetch. Jamieson must have what he needs to do the business. Tell him that, Ballantyne. I shall be behind him all the way, but we need an incident.
Ralph Ballantyne sat his horse on the heights of the escarpment, which fell away before him in a tumbled splendour of rocky hills and forests. The spring foliage turned the groves of masasa trees into clouds of pink and swelling scarlets, and the air was so clear and bright that he could pick out the telegraph line all the way to the horizon. The wires were a gossamer thread that glistened red gold in the sunlight, so fragile, so insubstantial, that it seemed impossible that they ran arrow straight 600 miles and more to meet the railhead at Kimberley. Ralph's men had laid this line, the surveyors riding ahead to set up the beacons, the axemen following to clear the line, then the wagons bringing up the poles, and finally the enormous spools of gleaming copper wire uncoiling endlessly.